On this week's On the Media, as the Capitol was breached, Fox News hosts were on the air blaming Antifa and left-wing infiltrators.
It is stunning, though, to think that at the same time that they were doing that, they were texting Mark Meadows to appeal to him to get Trump to call this off or dial it back.
From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. Plus, the highs and lows of the celebrity profile. One red flag that it might be a low?
An extensive description of what a celebrity is eating, because that almost always means that the profiler has only been given like an hour.
And a look at how fame changed during the pandemic, with wannabes taking center stage in place of absent A-listers.
Yes, being famous for being famous is an accurate portrayal of what they do, but also being famous is a job, and it's a hilarious one.
It's all coming up after this.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. As the dust was settling on the Capitol grounds on January 6th after the attempted insurrection, the hosts of Fox News were already weighing in with their branded bunkum.
There are some reports that Antifa sympathizers may have been sprinkled throughout the crowd. The Capitol was under siege by people who can only be described as antithetical to the MAGA movement.
They knew there were hundreds of thousands of people that came to town. We also knew that there's always bad actors that will infiltrate large crowds. I don't care if they're radical left, radical right, I don't know who they are.
Of course, we didn't know until this week that that same day they were sending texts with very different sentiments to White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows. Liz Cheney, the ranking Republican on the House Select Committee investigating the January 6th insurrection, read a few.
Quote, Mark, the president needs to tell people in the Capitol to go home. This is hurting all of us. He is destroying his legacy, Laura Ingraham wrote.
Meanwhile, on the air, Ingraham was saying,
because of a small contingent of loons, these patriots have been unfairly maligned.
Quote, can he make a statement? Ask people to leave the Capitol, Sean Hannity urged.
This week, Hannity said,
where is the outrage in the media over my private text messages being released again publicly? Do we believe in privacy in this country? Apparently not.
Angelo Carasone, CEO and president of Media Matters, a left-wing nonprofit that tracks misinformation in the right-wing media, told us why this particular Fox controversy is different from so many others, and why the coverage is better, too.
Because the rest of the news media has a much clearer lens to understand the relationship between Fox News and the rest of our civic and political landscape.
Because of the Trump years or because of the recent texts? What has provided that clarity?
It's partly attributable to the Trump years, for sure. But I actually think COVID changed the relationship between the rest of the news media and Fox News. Early on, Fox was calling it a hoax. They got a little bit of blowback for that. But when they went all in on hydroxychloroquine and then Trump himself started championing it, I think that that was the clearest illustration of the Trump-Fox pipeline. And so if you fast forward to now, when you see a moment like this, you know, the information media is not just covering it, but they're giving the context, which is that, you know, not only was Fox helping build the scaffolding for the attacks on January 6th, but running cover for Trump in the aftermath of it, while simultaneously, as these tests exposed, being pretty clear that they attributed it in part to him.
You know, we could, if we chose, do Fox every single week, right? But it's boring. You have to do it, and that's your brief.
it probably should be a large part of ours. But 21 years into this job, it's tough. But this was one we couldn't let go.
This is a stunning example of Fox News engaging in the kinds of partisan deceit that they're often accused of. There are a few moments these days that transcend the traditional partisan back and forth, but that was different and distinct. It was a real touchstone.
You're saying January 6th was?
It's not a touchstone anymore, for sure. But there was a moment in time for at least the first couple of days where it felt like that would be distinct, where that was something where we could all agree was not acceptable. That's partly why this is so powerful, because if you go back and look at the first day or so, there was a recognition that, whoa, that's too far. That's not okay. But what Fox, at the tip of the spear of the rest of the right-wing echo chamber, has been able to do successfully is turn what should be a pretty clear-cut example of no, too far, into an attack on Democrats and something to glorify. I mean, in the 6 months after the attacks on the Capitol, Fox News hosted members of Congress that had voted to overturn the election 600 times, creating a drumbeat and a narrative that, yeah, you know what? That election was stolen. We should have done something about it. And if you do that enough, long enough, what you start to do is minimize the threat, minimize the results, rewrite history. And then separately, you start to create a rationalization and even a justification for the events that unfolded.
Let's talk a bit about your organization, Angelo. This is what you do. You've been doing it for 12 years. You point out the misinformation, the hypocrisies, and the dangers of right-wing media. But let's be honest, isn't this futility built in?
I mean, it doesn't need to be. You know, I think there's a difference, though, between wanting something that's aligned with your perspective and something that is totally divorced from any fact. And what Fox does is they are not just pushing an ideology. They are working hand in glove with external forces, in this case, you know, the Trump campaign or the Republican Party, to build power. I mean, just like we saw with critical race theory, that was something that wasn't part of the conversation a year ago. But Fox News, over the course of 2.5 months, ran 1,900 segments about it this year, primed that pump, and it is now a new front in this broad array of culture wars that we are dealing with. So it's not their ideology or even the bubble that Media Matters is concerned with. The difference maker is the deceit mixed with calls to action and the organizing of power on what once was considered the fringes.
Glenn Beck, Bill O'Reilly, Roger Ailes are all gone.
Right.
Now you have Tucker Carlson in ascendance. It's like the Hydra of myth. You cut off the head and two grow back.
Well, yes. Glenn Beck being removed off of Fox News was a really big deal. Glenn Beck at 5 p.m., I mean, he was explosive. His audience was huge. His revenue for the show was off the charts. If advertisers did not walk away from the show when they did, what you would have seen is more Glenn Becks on Fox News. Alex Jones would have gotten a Fox News show because Glenn Beck would have changed the calculus and the business model. He would have moved the line.
But the market did react then, and the market now seems to be just fine.
Well, one, I would say the market is not totally fine. Tucker Carlson's show has lost a huge amount of advertising. Huge. I mean, he used to have 30 paid commercials a show. Now he's down to between 14 and 16.
And but Rush Limbaugh would lose advertising from time to time after one outrage or another.
Mm-hmm.
They'd always come back quietly under the cover of darkness.
That's true. But the radio piece is a little bit different. But I would say that Limbaugh lost a lot of stations, too. And the company that kept him on air was billions of dollars in debt. I mean, they were running at a loss for many, many years. Rush Limbaugh was not helping patch that up. If you draw the contrast with what's happening at Fox, advertising is no longer what is relevant to Fox News. What Fox did after Glenn Beck and then Bill O'Reilly, but it started after Glenn Beck, is the same way they built Fox News to make sure what happened to Richard Nixon never happened to another Republican president. I mean, that was literally in the organizing memo that Roger Ailes had drafted for it. What they did after Glenn Beck is they made sure that they would never be in that position again. They started to embark on a way of shifting their revenue model. Most TV shows care about commercials because that's where they get their major revenue stream. And what Fox did was change the revenue equation so that most of their revenue came from cable subscriptions. Ah. You know, Fox is the second most expensive channel on everybody's cable box right now. ESPN is number one. Just to show how powerful that is, Fox News could have $0 in advertising revenue, not a single commercial. They could run ad-free, and they would still have a 90% profit margin. No other commercial TV channel operates like that.
But hold on here. Does one subscribe to Fox?
No.
Isn't it a basic cable channel?
That's right. Everybody that has cable is forced to pay for Fox News and Fox Business. The way it works is if you have a cable company, you pay a channel a nominal fee to broadcast it. Your subscribers don't subscribe to the channels. You offer them a package. What Fox decided to do through a series of highly controversial moves over the last decade is force cable companies to pay them way more than a nominal fee in order to provide it to their customers. That is something that every cable customer then has to pay for by extension. So Fox News currently gets about $2.50 from every single person that has cable. Fox Business gets about 30 cents a subscriber. That means about $300 million in revenue a year. Nobody watches Fox Business. They have tens of thousands of viewers on a good day. Mm. That's the same amount of revenue that MSNBC gets from cable companies, even though they have 1 million to 2 million viewers. It has nothing to do with viewership. It has everything to do with how you negotiate and how rabid your audience can be in pressuring cable companies, ironically, to increase the bill for everybody. Mm-hmm. Fox News no longer needs commercials. And that's why we're in a period right now where it feels like they're even further removed from any kind of accountability.
But you say you're optimistic. Why?
For three reasons. One, because the rest of the news media is clear-eyed about the threat of Fox News and the need for there to be some line finally drawn, that takes away a really important headwind and it helps build consensus. And that consensus has started to form that Fox News is a destructive force and needs to be held accountable.
Where is that happening?
In the news media, whether it's former media reporters from the Baltimore Sun that used to go on Fox News that have criticized it, to people like Bill Kristol, who's a conservative, to Chris Wallace, who was a stalwart part of Fox News for decades, leaving the channel and on his way out, pointing out that it's an extraordinary thing when Fox News does not interfere in your show. The second reason is that there are 90 million cable customers in the country. There are 3 million Fox viewers on average. That means that there are way more non-Fox viewers than Fox viewers. And then the third is that there's an opportunity. So because Fox News has abandoned the commercials as their primary revenue driver, they've gone all in on cable contract renewals. And coming up this year, Fox is going to actually go through a series of major renewals with these cable companies. And in order to offset all of the losses from advertising over the past couple of years, in part because of Tucker and the extremism, they not only have to keep their high number, they actually have to go from $2.50 a subscriber to over $3. That's a big jump. And so there's a campaign on Fox My Cable Box, that's the name of it. And the same way that Fox News organizes their viewers to contact cable companies to say, hey, you better keep Fox News. Our simple ask is this: don't raise our bill. Don't make us pay more money for Fox News. And in fact, you shouldn't be forcing us to pay for Fox Business at all. There's really no rational basis for that. So everybody is always mad at their cable companies because their bills are so high. And a big part of the reason why their bill is so high is because Fox News keeps forcing it to go higher.
That being said, Fox isn't the only game in right-wing media. And it's interesting to see Newsmax host Rob Schmidt ask Mark Meadows about these texts, even if Fox wouldn't.
Yep.
But really, do the new players in right-wing media change anything for Fox? Could they just replace Fox?
My fear with these emerging platforms, One America News in particular, was that if they were able to ankle bite on Fox News, that because Trump and their relationship with parts of the Trump audience, that they could leverage that to force cable companies to pick them up. The effect of that on all of us would be that it would accelerate the movement of Fox News increasingly to the right. It'd make Fox News more extreme. Here's the evidence. Fox News called Arizona for Joe Biden the night of the election. They got a ton of blowback from their own audience and from Donald Trump mm-hmm. about that. They then spent the next 2 weeks in 774 individual instances challenging the very results of the election that they called. to try to compensate for angering their base is that it demonstrates that instead of Fox trying to keep their current footing or move more to a sensible place, they have now made it a part of their strategy to race further and further to the extreme to stake out that terrain, block out any potential competitors.
So whence your optimism?
I look at this from a cold business calculus.
Okay.
They've lost a few $100 million in revenue from advertising. This is real money. And what they've done is they've created an inflection point, a decision point. Usually it's spread out. And the decision point for all of us is actually coming up this year. That's mm-hmm. rare. We just don't get that. Mm-hmm. And the second reason why I have some optimism is that because there is a consensus forming around the destructive power of Fox News, it incentivizes the call to action, which is to go to cable companies and say, do not make me pay more money for Fox News.
You don't just cover Fox, though. You do cover One American News Network. You do cover Newsmax. If Fox did suddenly, poof, go away, which it won't, but let's say it did, you wouldn't be out of a job.
No. We are concerned with the problem of misinformation. And obviously, a lot of that is moving increasingly into the tech platforms, into online. Our role would change. And that's okay. Fox provides a distinct threat that requires a much more focused and concerted response. But what we really should be doing is research. I mean, if you want to know how many times cable news talked about climate change over the course of a year compared to other topics or other news channels, we can give that stat in a second. We can run a report, say, wow, no, they only spent 13 seconds on it this month. Earlier this year, when the wildfires were taking over parts of the country, we were able to show very quickly that in the first few days of coverage, there was no contextualization between the wildfires and climate change. And we were able to hold a mirror up to reporters to say, you're enabling misinformation by not providing this connective tissue and context. There's a role for watchdogs in any arena, especially the media now. I wish that was the day-to-day that we were doing instead of thinking about how some particularly insidious forces, one of which is Fox, is increasingly organizing power on the fringes with destructive effect.
Angelo, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Angelo Carasone is the president and CEO of Media Matters, a progressive nonprofit that monitors misinformation in the right-wing media. Coming up, a New Yorker piece about a star on the Fox-inflected show Succession raises questions about what we really want from the celebrity profile. This is On the Media.
I'm Helga Davis, and my show is all about the art of fearless conversation.
The wonder of dialogue is that what you think is so obvious gets really questioned at a deep level.
Sometimes the truth is having those uncomfortable discussions that get to facts that we usually don't want to talk about.
Join me for a new season of Helga, wherever you get podcasts.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. This week, the HBO Bleakly comic series Succession won 5 Golden Globe nominations, more than any other show, hot on the heels of its season 3 finale. The series is about a dysfunctional media dynasty. It tracks how a tyrannical mogul father, Logan Roy, often likened to Rupert Murdoch, but who contains elements of many such types, played by Brian Cox, abuses his position and his very wealthy adult kids, portrayed by Alan Ruck, Sarah Snook, Kieran Culkin, and Jeremy Strong. They maneuver and vie for their father's approval and power, sometimes in the shadows, other times in the spotlight. Here, son Kendall Roy, played by Strong, performs a rap to an aghast gala audience in honor of his pop.
L to the OG, do be the OG, and he playing, make some noise.
This month, The New Yorker published a profile of the actor who plays Kendall, written by staff writer Michael Shulman, detailing his actorly process and career. As its devastating title, Jeremy Strong doesn't get the joke suggests, it was resolutely not a puff piece. It portrayed Strong as humorlessly devoted to his job to the point of irritating his colleagues and even misunderstanding his character. Since the profile was published, an argument has ensued. Succession's executive producer, Adam McKay, quoted in The New Yorker, likened Strong's performance as Kendall to Hamlet, commenting that Strong was cast, quote, precisely because of his passion, the New Yorker writer mocks. Aaron Sorkin published a statement saying the profile offered a distorted picture. Jessica Chastain also decried the portrayal. Anne Helen Peterson wrote her dissertation on the history of celebrity gossip. She also writes Culture Study, a newsletter on Substack. Welcome back to the show, Anne.
I am so pleased to be here.
Recently, The New Yorker released a statement about the profile, quote, "This is a nuanced, multi-sided portrait of an extremely dedicated actor." And I just wonder whether you think that's true.
Yes. You know, it's great that someone had to ask The New Yorker to comment on its profile. It's a profile that has a point of view, that makes an argument. It has an artistry to it in terms of the way that it arranges the quotes from Strong himself, from other directors and actors and other people within Hollywood, and the commentary from the author. And that commentary is, as the title proclaims, that he doesn't really get the joke, right? He doesn't understand the ways in which the show Succession is a comedy, and that he also is very self-serious when it comes to his craft. Mm-hmm. And I think it's important to note a lot of people who read it without reading commentary or uproar on Twitter probably read the article as just being a little bit critical or interesting or compelling. They didn't necessarily think of it as a hit piece. And I don't think it's a hit piece.
Well, you know, it wasn't a hit piece, but the interviewer said things like, "His mild appearance belies a relentless, sometimes preening intensity."
I mean, I think that it probably feels pretty accurate. I have analyzed so many profiles to see the adjectives that come up again and again when a celebrity is profiled. And oftentimes, those adjectives are uniformly positive. They're not actually descriptive. They're puffery. Mm-hmm. And a profile is not a mirror image, right? Every documentary, every piece of photography, it has a point of view.
Every piece of journalism.
Yes, every piece of journalism. And that includes celebrity journalism. I think we're used to effacing that point of view because we think of it as unserious journalism or infotainment. But what the author of this particular profile chose to do was to highlight the similarities between Jeremy Strong as an individual, as an actor, and the character that he plays on Succession, Kendall Roy. And those mm-hmm. similarities really come out and make a compelling argument. I think it's really interesting. But we're so unaccustomed to any celebrity profile that takes that sort of point of view, that it feels very remarkable. It feels bombastic.
So that's why you think it struck a nerve, because it was just a shock, as you wrote, in a media landscape where the stars hold nearly all the media power.
Yeah, so the history of celebrity over the last 100 years is really a history of the pendulum swinging back and forth between celebrities having more power and the publications or the larger apparatus of publicity that upholds them having more power and more leverage. And in this particular moment, because of digital media and gossip blogs, but most importantly, the rise of social media accounts for celebrities, they wield almost unprecedented levels of power in the history of celebrity. So they can exact whatever conditions that they would like, in most cases, in order to get a pretty softball profile. And in this case, the prestige of The New Yorker and just the way that New Yorker historically does profiles is that they're a little bit more willing to puncture the myths that a star perpetuates around themselves. They can be a little bit more lancy in it, but that is very rare.
So give me some examples of the lows of the form of the celebrity profile to which you seem to be alluding.
Well, I mean, it depends on how you describe low.
empty, banal, boring, predictable. I got a million of
them. This is controversial, but I think that the most boring profiles recently are the ones in which Beyonce effectively interviews herself, right? And these are for prestigious publications like Vogue, Harper's Bazaar, where the way that they're set up is sometimes an as told to, mm-hmm. where it's clear that the questions that are asked of her are questions that she has come up with. It's fascinating from a sort of meta perspective of like, what are the questions that Beyonce thinks are interesting about herself? And they remind me of these profiles or personal essays supposedly written by the major Hollywood stars. Like Marilyn Monroe supposedly wrote an essay that was all about, I love being domestic. I love cooking meat for Joe DiMaggio.
She can't possibly have written that.
No, of course not. Yeah. It was a press agent. And they were trying to create this counterbalance of like, she is actually at heart domestic.
Right.
That would balance out the belief at that moment that she is actually pure sex.
Do you have any red flags that would tell people that they're perhaps reading a subpar profile?
Yes. An extensive description of what a celebrity is eating. Because that almost always means that the profiler has only been given like an hour that you can have lunch with that person. And so in order to fill the space, to create any sort of color, you have to describe what the celebrity is eating. There's this famous or infamous profile of Penelope Cruz in Esquire from 2014 that is just describing her eating a steak for about 1,000 words. But I've known celebrity profilers who can take 30 minutes, an hour with a celebrity and turn it into something really interesting. But they have to ask questions that are provocative.
You've also noted that the approaches are frequently gendered.
Yes. What happens when a woman is profiled, the profile focuses on their relationships in a pretty surface level way. There's not really much of interest that you can get someone to say unless the star comes into the profile with a piece of information that they want to lead the news cycle. Mm-hmm. And a great example of this is Jennifer Aniston saying in a profile that Brad Pitt had a sensitivity chip missing. Like she worked with her publicist to figure out, okay, what am I going to say that people are going to draw from this profile? But that doesn't mean that the profile itself was interesting.
The Hollywood critique of the strong profile at least seemed to be that it wasn't just shallow or anything like that, but that it was unfair.
Well, it's interesting. You know, a couple people I've spoken to, just, you know, normal readers have said, oh, I thought it was uncharitable that every anecdote, whether it was like living in the basement of Michelle Williams' house, that sort of thing, like that it was in some way interpreted as part of this larger method conversation, this part of dedication to acting.
Like when you played Jerry Rubin in the Trial of the Chicago 7, he asked the director, Aaron Sorkin, to spray him with tear gas so he could have that experience.
Right. Well, and it's, I think, sometimes considered as taking himself too seriously for the sort of performance that he's doing. So Daniel Day-Lewis, like no one's like, oh, how dare Daniel Day-Lewis become a cobbler to like approximate his role in a film, right?
Right.
Like that is thought of as part of his process because he is arguably the greatest actor in the world. But also Daniel Day-Lewis doesn't really give interviews. So there's no opportunities for people to lambast him.
And of course, Daniel Day-Lewis was a hero for Jeremy Strong. Mm-hmm. He worked very hard to work on sets that Daniel Day-Lewis worked on. You did make the observation, though, that for the vast majority of people, talking about the acting process is almost guaranteed to make you sound like an a-hole.
Yes. Well, and that really comes out, too, in the contrast between Jeremy Strong and Brian Cox, who is like a classically trained Shakespearean actor who does not allow his performances to bleed out into these other portions of his life. Or even with someone like Kieran Culkin, who grew up as a child actor, right? Who has naturalized mm-hmm. some of these performances of acting and has a different approach to the way that he thinks about acting. So I think those contrasts come out in the profile as well.
So let's talk about The New Yorker then, which is uniquely positioned to publish a profile that cuts or lances like this profile of Strong did.
Yeah, and I think a lot of this has to do with the fact The New Yorker is not beholden to celebrities for the fate of its publication. And so when they do decide to reach out to profile someone, it is still really treated as a tremendous honor. Judging from the access that has been given for previous interviews, agreeing to a profile means agreeing to several days of access, extended interview time, connecting the author of the profile with high-profile secondary interviews, so people that you know, your parents, your kids, your fellow actors and directors and that sort of thing.
But you also suggested that The New Yorker was historically excellent at drawing blood, and you weren't meaning it as a takedown, but something that you said was far more skillful and surgical.
Yeah, I think it's more of almost an ambivalence. So when you read a profile on The New Yorker, I think you often come away from it wondering, is this good? Is this bad? Is this positive? Is this negative? And I think that oftentimes the subject of the profile itself probably wonders that as well. And I do kind of wonder if Jeremy Strong would have felt a similar ambivalence to this profile, mm-hmm. if not for the Twitter reaction, which was like, this is negative, this is a takedown. Because in form, it's very similar to many different profiles, not just of celebrities, but of, you know, startup founders, philanthropists, famous academics. Like, it is just a style that is trying to show the reader instead of tell them what to think.
You suggest that the banal celebrity profile tells the reader that there's nothing to see here, at least nothing actually worth interrogating. But the Lansing profiles, they linger because they make you question the organization and accumulation of power, or at least they should.
Power creates publicity for itself that is meant to make it feel less threatening.
Right.
That is meant to remind readers that you should admire the fact that I have a lot of money and power, but you shouldn't be mad about it. It anesthetizes the masses. And that's what the banal celebrity profile does, is it's like, oh yeah, Elon Musk, he's the person of the year. He has a lot of money. That's cool. Like, I shouldn't be mad about that. Instead of thinking about the widening financial and social inequities of our time. When I look back and read the celebrity profiles of the late 1920s and 1930s and 1940s, it's really interesting how they try to soften the wealth of the Hollywood stars. They are actually participating in the war effort, or they have very plain homes, very simple lifestyles, because at that moment, they understood that if the masses turned on the stars and said, we won't go to these movies. Like, I mean, Hollywood would be over.
So the Jeremy Strong profile is an example, perhaps, of the journalistic establishment wresting back power from the celebrity. To what end?
Well, this is interesting, right? More people read that profile in The New Yorker, I'm sure, than have read most profiles that have run in The New Yorker recently, or in other magazines as well. So publications are trying to figure out, how do you get people to read a celebrity profile? How do you convince a celebrity that doing a photo shoot for the cover of a magazine is still worth their time? What if you said, like, the more access you give us, the more interesting the profile will be, the more people will be interested in you in general. Mm-hmm. I think that Jeremy Strong became a quasi-household name over the course of the last 2 weeks, when before most people just knew him as Kendall Roy. That's interesting from, like, a publicity point of view. And I would be so fascinated to know what his publicists think of all of this.
There's no such thing as bad publicity?
I don't think it's as simple as that. I think that they probably think that this is an opportunity for him to make his next move, you know, mm-hmm. like whether that's him doing another interview that tries to counter how that profile came off, or him getting cast in something because of renewed interest. it is definitely a pivot point in his career.
What then should the best kind of celebrity profile do? Both as a piece of journalism, a piece of art, and a piece of potential social engineering.
Wow, this is asking a lot. I think a good profile holds power to account in some way, and without opening up the celebrity to pot shots about all sorts of different parts of their personality that don't actually matter. And then I also want it to be interesting and funny and to have a point of view. I want to remember it.
Anne, thank you very much.
It was my true and total pleasure.
Anne Helen Peterson wrote her dissertation on the history of celebrity gossip. She also writes Culture Study, a newsletter on Substack, and recently co-authored the book Out of Office, The Big Problem and Bigger Promise of Working from Home. While we're on the subject of celebrities, what's the difference between a who and a them? The answer, coming up. This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. The celebrity profile, as we've just heard, has struggled in a world of splintered media and DIY publicity. But there's a subset of aspiring boldface names who'd sacrifice much for 2,000 words all about them, good or Lansing. They are the desperate wannabes at the heart of the podcast, Who Weekly, hosted by Bobby Finger and Lindsay Weber. Each week, the duo, former journalists for Vulture and Jezebel, pour over Instagram comments, notes app apologies, clapback videos, and People magazine captions to investigate the process whereby the non-famous attempt to climb the blood-stained rungs of celebrity. We asked Bobby and Lindsay to record an end-of-the-year segment for us, but before we get to that, welcome to the show, guys.
Hi.
Hi, thanks for having us.
So let's first deal with the basics. Tell me how you defined who's and them's.
Think of yourself as being in the checkout line for a supermarket, and you see an Us Weekly or a People, and if you see someone on the cover who you recognize, your Will Smiths or Jennifer Anistons, you say, oh, them. But if you see someone that you've never seen before, like maybe a reality star or someone on a show you don't watch, or maybe just an Instagram influencer, you might say, who?
In Rachel Syme's discussion of your show in The New Yorker, she wrote that you are, quote, primarily anthropologists, and that your aim is to taxonomize a new celebrity species, one that emerged in the 21st century with the rise of social media and smartphones. So tell me a little bit about the taxonomy.
That's very kind of her, when ultimately what it boils down to is it's our opinion. So we made this up and we get to say who's what. No, I think we've kind of set many little rules over the passage of time, you know, the way that they respond to being in media, how they seek out media, how they use different like social platforms. Do they even use them at all? So we've kind of planted these little rules and things that obviously change because, again, it's our opinion, that define the who's versus the them's.
I think you used the word desperate in your lovely introduction to us, but I think there's a lot to be said for desperation or at least desire. Like, these are the people who really want to be talked about. They aren't people who shiver at a headline about them. They love it. They want people to know who they are, and they are acutely aware of the fact that that begins with them having no idea who they are and asking a lot of questions. So I think that helps us find the people that we talk about. Like, who are the people who really want attention from us?
A lot of us can name the cast of Friends or point out Brad Pitt in a checkout rack magazine, but we aren't ever going to know the who's. There's so many of them.
There's too many of them.
I think something that's helpful is our call-in show. Sometimes there are celebrities who we may not consider even talking about because they sort of toe the line between who and something we'd like to call just Nas, people who aren't famous enough, may not be seeking out the attention. But if we get enough calls from our listeners, that helps flag certain people who we may not consider otherwise.
It's not just about who somebody is because they're on a show you like and you're just not quite sure what actor it is. It's also like, why is this person being recognized? Who's their fandom? What is actually the deal behind them having any sort of notoriety at all? And that's a lot of the questions that we get, which is the most fascinating.
What ultimately, if you were going to put together your body of work, what would someone draw from it?
I think that what we are going for, aside from just giving people a good laugh, because ultimately this stuff is funny, mm-hmm. is that fame itself is there's no rules, but also, you know, all press is good press. And the longer that we exist, the more we're able to see specific who's kind of navigate that. I mean, mm-hmm. we have an entire segment on Rita Ora, who is one of our all-time favorite who's. And the reason is because she is never not in the media doing all of the various things that she does.
I have no idea who she is.
Exactly.
Perfect.
I mean, she's a singer, she's an actress, she's a media icon, truly. You should know who she is because you're on the media.
Yeah,
she's always on the media.
One of the really interesting things about your show is that it's not judgmental. You seem to have a grudging respect for the desperate who.
Well, it takes a lot of work, and I think that we're the ones who see it. I mean, especially, again, in the example of Rita Ora, not everyone can just get press like that, and not everyone can do what a lot of these who's can do. And so I think in a way we are obviously trying to laugh along with them, and we try not to be judgmental.
Yeah, and I feel like in the late aughts, early 2010s, there was this whole new conversation being had about the famous people who were famous for being famous, and mm-hmm. that's a sort of condescending way to discuss that sort of mm-hmm. fame. Exactly. And I think what we find delightful is that, yes, being famous for being famous is an accurate portrayal of what they do, but also being famous is a job, and it's a hilarious one. And so when that is your job, more so than, oh, I'm an actor on this, I'm a writer on this, any sort of like artist in some way, like when your job is to be famous, that's funny.
I think it's funny because it's tragic.
Oh, I don't find it tragic at all.
At all. Because I think they're getting what they want. It would be tragic right. if they were struggling for something and couldn't attain it.
This is not the Beyoncés and Britney Spears who get too much fame and are like, oh no. Because as you know, once you're the most famous person in the world, it's quite lonely. It's quite destructive to your
life. And they're thems.
Right, they're thems. We're talking about the who's. People who get a beer bought for them at the bar. They sign an autograph. They love the attention. And like, we're dealing with the people who find joy in the process. Mm. And we find humor in that joy. And we're all hopefully working together on this.
So we came out of an interview about celebrity profiles. What prompted it was the New Yorker profile of Jeremy Strong. I'm wondering, is Jeremy Strong now a them or still a who? And is Succession a who or them show?
Wow. Bobby, you get to deal with
this. Well, I think character actors are always tough. And because Jeremy is so, I guess, I mean, we learned this in the profile, dedicated to his craft, and he doesn't really exist outside of the work. He's so obsessive over that. I think he would be a who, because he's not really out here hungry for the type of fame that we talk about. He's just here to work.
Anything that's particularly niche, we tend to put in a who bucket, too.
I think the show is a them. Despite the ratings, compared to an HBO show like Game of Thrones, the ratings aren't that high. But in terms of the cultural conversation, it's deafening at this point. So I think that helps make it a them.
Such a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Now that we've explained your terms of art, let's listen to the segment you recorded for us regarding celebrity in 2021, Who Weekly style.
Early on in the pandemic, we're talking, I think, day two of lockdown, Gal Gadot and her friends, most A-listers, aka thems, released their dreaded, I wish I could forget it, Imagine video.
Imagine all the people.
In which they sang Imagine for no reason from their mansions and told everyone that it was going to be okay based on pretty much nothing, based on their own comfort. And it seems like after that, they all went into hiding.
All these movies were delayed. TV shows were delayed. They weren't able to film. Things just got pushed back. And therefore, a lot of the big stars, the thems, the A-listers, they said, well, we don't have to do press, so we're not going to be out there. We're not going to give you those tabloid shots. We're not going to give you the paparazzi pics you need. So to fill the void, a lot of tabloids and celebrity media put in the who's. The who's were available. They were posting on Instagram. They were still calling the paparazzi. And therefore, they kind of filled that hole, therefore kind of shifting the entire medium of celebrities. We cared more about who's all of a sudden there they were.
The most Googled celebrity of 2020 was Addison Rae, who is a TikTok star.
I'm going to try this mascara. I know I already have a ton of mascara on.
We wanted to know about Addison Rae and other TikTok stars and lesser known celebrities simply because we wanted celebrities in our lives in some way, and they were filling the void.
That's true. We were so bored.
Right. We needed an escape, and the A-listers weren't doing the work. The Who's were doing the work. And we got worried that we would lose this A-list sensibility in the future. But in going through the calendar year, it's fun to see them all come out of hiding slowly but surely to the point where in December, everyone's here. Let's just begin in January. One of the big themmy things that happened in January happened on January 5th.
It's official. Kim Kardashian and Kanye West's love story is coming to an end.
Kim and Kanye announced their divorce, two of the biggest stars on the planet, at the very least in the United States. It took us all by surprise, and we were all captivated.
Other two interesting things that happened in the next few months that really, like, had A-listers back in the forefront was the Free Britney documentary premiered. Having Britney Spears back in the limelight again was an interesting thing, despite really the story being about her wanting to be away from the limelight. Somehow she was back as a conversation point. The other thing that happened that was really interesting was the Oprah special with Meghan Markle and Prince Harry. It was a huge one.
Were you silent or were you silenced?
It was one of the first pieces of must-see television during the pandemic.
Yes,
where
everybody
it
was watching.
Like everyone was watching this piece of live television together and commenting on it. And even though so much of it was very depressing and very dark and very sad, she talked about her racist experiences within the royal family, among other things.
We had to go to this event, and I remember him saying, I don't think you can go. And I said, I can't be left alone.
Because you were afraid of what you might do to yourself?
It was something that we all talked about and experienced together. And that felt like a real turning point in the pandemic.
I think the missing piece that people really craved was like mass media. We were all watching Mayor of Easttown. That's the best that we could do, right? But we missed that celebrity event, which is interesting because then the Oscars roll around and everyone's so excited for the Oscars. But what happens is they have to do the pared down Oscars, understandably. Mm-hmm. And we thought, oh, if they get this right, this could be the way the Oscars are moving forward. As it turns out, nobody liked them at all. They were awful. Mm-hmm. They straight up did not work.
And I'll never forget the opening of the Oscars. They were directed by Steven Soderbergh. They were so excited they showed Regina King walking down the hallway.
Ladies and gentlemen, Regina King.
And then instantly after her opening speech, everything else dropped like a thud. It was so disappointing.
What other big things shifted us back into the them-dom culture we craved?
What was funny is that so much of it was like, oh, I wish we could go back to normal, aka 2019, but it turns out the most successful strategy was to go back in time even further. In the middle of the year, a good midpoint was when two old pieces of American pop culture came back in a roaring way.
Where's the tissue box?
The cast of Friends.
The Friends reunion, which has been delayed a million times and finally comes to fruition, our best friends back together again or whatever.
Our best friends.
We cared so much. And then as if God heard us all pleading for a big, spicy story, Bennifer, J-Lo, and Ben Affleck, after years of being apart, get back together.
The kiss scene around the world. Yes, Ben and Jen are certainly not shy in showing off their PDA.
Really, it's insane that this all happened this year.
And then, unfortunately, the summer, I think, was a dud. We thought we'd get big summer blockbusters. People still weren't comfortable going out to the movies. We stayed indoors. We hunkered down. But then at the beginning of the fall, celebrities once again tried to pop back out and go back to old times.
In New York City last night, the biggest and most tone-deaf stars got all dolled up for the annual Met Gala.
The Met Gala, you know, it definitely fixed some of the things the Oscars messed up on, right? Like,
yes.
The Met Gala definitely said, we're going to be big and glamorous as we always are.
And one of the moments of the Met Gala that made me think, oh, we're heading back in the right direction. Things are going to be okay, is at the very end when we had been waiting, watching the red carpet coverage online for hours. I'm talking hours and hours. And we're wondering who our number one Met Gala queen is. And then finally she shows up at the end.
OMG, my girl Rihanna, finally on the red carpet at the Met Gala. And she is making it official with ASAP Rocky Rihanna.
This is as A-list as it gets. Absolutely.
Perfect.
Like, this feels comfortable
to me. Rihanna at the Met Gala was like, we're home.
We're home. We're home.
Right after that, movies were back. So you had the release of James Bond. You had the release of Dune, which was a huge movie. You have, mm-hmm. despite movies going to streaming first sometimes, they were still going back into theaters as well. And therefore, the A-listers were coming out and doing press for them the same way that they always did.
I saw Dune in theaters twice, and I could have watched it at home. I was so desperate to get back to same. Big budget monoculture movie going.
Same.
Which takes us right to November. We have been waiting for a new Adele album for years and years and years, and it finally happened in November.
And talk about mass media. It felt like everybody had a listen.
Adele got the very classic, comfortable press coverage. She was on the cover of every magazine possible. She went on every talk show possible. She also talked to Oprah. Like, she was giving us the press tour that we had grown conditioned to before the pandemic.
Even a huge star-studded performance that was aired on TV at the Griffith Observatory in LA. Even a TV special she got.
Good evening, everyone. I'm Oprah Winfrey. Right now, it is my great delight to introduce the 15-time Grammy-winning icon, Adele!
Lindsay, more people watched that than watched the Oscars.
Oh, yeah, it doesn't surprise me one
we're
bit.
Back.
Right,
we're
so
back.
Truly we're back. We had to care about Addison Rae, and now we're like, Addison who?
As exciting as it is to meet new who's, there's something so comforting about the people you already know and love, you know?
I know, it's true.
Addison Rae cannot compete.
Hello.
Bobby Finger and it's Lindsay me. Weber are the co-hosts of the podcast Who Weekly. One last thing before you go, and the answer is so obvious, and I'm just saying it because Katya, our executive producer, put it in the prep. On the media, who or them?
You guys are a who, I'm sorry.
You're a who, you're a who.
Your beloved niche who, you love the media.
Niche who.
So do we.
You're who's.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Micah Lowinger, Eloise Blondio, Rebecca Clark Callender, and Eli Cohen, with help from Jawaria Wright. Zandra Ellen writes our newsletter. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Adrian Lilly. Katya Rogers is our executive producer. On the Media is a production of WNYC Studios. I'm Brooke Gladstone.